I'm still regretting it, I think. But I'm Aaron. I'm an alcoholic and addict. I fly on HP power a lot of the time, and I was sitting here in when I first started working here, and Chris had said, like, tonight we have such and such. I had somebody cancel on me at the last minute, and I kind of something clicked in my head, like, one day you might just get, like, hijacked into doing this. So I kind of have thought about, like, the fear around it. And I have a lot of social anxiety, and I have a lot of fear. And I have learned in this program not to let that stop me and have been comfortable with being uncomfortable. So I'm mildly prepared. Okay. So let me have a piece of gum. That helps me with my anxiety. So I'm not from Austin. I'm not from Texas. I was born and raised in Des Moines, Iowa. I've lived several different places. I lived in New Orleans for 10 years. My story escalates there. So my mother and my father, when I was young, that their condition and their situation played a part of part in my recovery and my alcohol and drug use. My mom, she had mental illness, and she was schizophrenic, and so there were some outbursts and some like psychotic snaps. And my dad was an alcoholic. I really wasn't fully aware of kind of what was going on with him until I got to be probably in junior high, late elementary. But I do remember as a very little kid that my dad was kind of sporadically not coming home at night, and I was missing him, and I wanted to stay up and wait for him to come home. And this was like the first time I recognized something wasn't wrong and made it a link to alcohol. I was sleeping on the couch waiting for him to come home, and I got woken up to like loud records and my dad, like drunk party stuff. And I immediately was terrified. And I hadn't done anything wrong. I just wanted to see my dad, but I knew something was wrong then. And I kind of had a little sense that it had to do something to do with alcohol. And there was like argument and fight and stuff like that. So growing up, I pinpointed that this happy family that I wanted wasn't there because my dad drank. And growing up, I didn't want alcohol. I was angry. I had a lot of anger around that because of the situation. So I smoked pot. My brother was 5 years older than me. So when he was about 15 and he was experimenting with stuff, I was 10. And I'd pester him and pester him. So, he would give in. And it was something, I liked how it made me feel. I liked being a part of it. I liked the social aspect that I was getting to hang out with my older brother and his cool friends and stuff. So I really took to it. And I smoked pot like all the way through junior high and all that stuff. And I was going to parties where my brother would throw keggers and I would go there. And I didn't like alcohol. I still hated it. But I would force myself to drink a beer just to be a part, of the social aspect of it and fit in. And I did that for about a year or so. And it's really weird because that first drink, I didn't like it. And I didn't really care for the effect that it had on me. But I just kept doing it because I wanted to fit in, and I wanted to hang out with my older brother. And then later on, as I got to be in, in high school, I kind of, I dropped out. I was a stoner big time, and I sold drugs and stuff. And that was everything to me. That was my whole world. So I didn't do schooling. The whole situation around my family and my living, I could have gone to school. I could have, I could have applied myself, and I could have changed that. But I didn't see that as a solution. To me, pot was my solution. It made me feel good. It brought me friends. I made money off of it. So I continued to do that. And then when I was in high school, I started partying a little bit more and drinking a little bit more. And the people I hung out with, they were way more drinkers. So my drinking increased. And still at that time, I still looked at alcohol as the thing that took my family away. Even though I would kind of do it, it wasn't like anything that I embraced. It was still, I still had a part of me that was like, I hate alcohol. I hate what it's done. So it's kind of weird that something I didn't even really feel attracted to and I didn't even really have a lot of good experiences with in the first time still pulled me in. And in high school, of course, you know, I'm hanging out and partying and I had some good experiences and alcohol was there. But again, it became like all that partying and everything, it became my whole world. It was everything to me. I eventually ended up getting like a GED and I went off to college just because I had a girlfriend at the time that went and I wanted to know what she was doing. And it was a new place to sell, you know, pot and then LSD. And I drank there. That's kind of when my drinking became a problem. Because up until then, it was just, I was a normie. I was like just a social drinker. I definitely had marijuana substance problems for sure. That was, I mean, I was the everyday kind of smoker. And, but alcohol hadn't been that until I got to college. And then I had relationship stuff. And I just hit that age, you know, I was coming up on 21 and I had been drinking socially for a certain amount of time. And at some point, this thing just takes over. And I'm in a party college town. And that's when I started drinking and getting drunk and getting wasted. And, you know, having behaviors that I wouldn't, that were all beyond my control, you know, that kind of thing where I'm not just socially relaxed, I am a whole nother person. And, you know, I'm saying mean stuff, or I'm just like enjoying something that I wouldn't normally enjoy, like, you know, I don't know, running around the streets doing stuff that I wouldn't normally do, fucking with people's crap. Because I kind of was like a nice kid. Coming up, I didn't really get angry and hateful until around that time. That's when I had a bad breakup, and I was heavy into alcohol, and I went more into it. I drank every night after the breakup, and I drank heavy. And then my brother, he was living in New Orleans, so I moved down to New Orleans. And New Orleans is the kind of place where you can be you don't even have to be a functioning alcoholic to seem normal, that people are so drunk all the time. Like, the businesses there, you know, they are like, they'll have the suggested hours, you know. It's like, they might open at 11. Many times I went to some place that said it opened at 11, and it wouldn't be open till like 1, and they'd come in hungover. And it was just kind of a normal thing there. So that was the first time that I really went insane with the alcohol. I mean, I just got ripped. And they had a new element to my life, which was cocaine. They sold cocaine at the bars. And I did it because I could drink longer. And I could, you know, be out late. I remember many times going to the bar at like 5 p.m. and not going home until the next day at 11 a.m. And that was like the real deep, deep, incomprehensible and pitiful demoralization on that one. And it wasn't, you know, that I really felt shitty after those times. No matter how much fun I thought I had those nights, the morning after, the come down was so brutal and so hard, and I felt so poisoned. But I didn't see stopping as a real thing. I didn't see it as this will fix that. I didn't, you know, I had to figure out how to make it work. I had to drink more water, had to smoke less cigarettes, I had to do a little bit less drinking, and maybe balance this cocaine and drinking thing right, or whatever. I've been that way from that time on. Everything that I did with drugs and alcohol was all about trying to figure out that special formula that makes it work. And then down there, I had another breakup, which sent me, I had a lot of emotional problems, a lot of emotional baggage, so these relationships were inevitably doomed to fail. And I had tons of, you know, substance use problems. So another one failed. And this time I felt really suicidal. And it was the drinking and cocaine, man. The depression that comes with that is unreal. Like, it made me so unbalanced. I'm a little bit manic depressive, but that stuff sent me into lows that I had never reached before. And I got really suicidal, very feeling like I just don't, there's nothing for me to live for at all. And from what I knew about heroin, you do it, you become addicted, and then you accidentally OD every time. And I figured, like in my lack of knowledge, that this was going to happen in like a month. You know, it'll make you feel good, and then you'll be dead in a month, and it's all taken care of. That was my suicide plan. And, you know, surprisingly, for somebody who doesn't know anything about heroin, I found it very quickly in New Orleans. That place is fucking riddled with drugs. So that was a new thing. And it kind of worked out to be a little bit beneficial for me, because in the midst of that, I felt relief from my suicidal feelings and all my feelings. And what it did for me made me not want anything else ever, ever again. And so that kind of like cured me of all drugs. Now I just got this one drug to take care of. And I battled with getting clean off of that for years. I would get clean and I would make it a few days, maybe a week, and I would feel crappy and I'd want to go back, but I'd still, you know, I'm like, I know it doesn't work, but I didn't know how to live sober. I didn't know what to do next. I get clean and I don't know what to do next. I didn't have any program. I didn't have any of that stuff. So then Katrina hit. And I had been in a rehab, like a live-in program for 90 days. I had been clean off of heroin. I had been completely sober. And by this time, pot had made me nervous, and I was moving on to pills and bigger things. So that I never looked back on that. Which I kind of think is kind of a gateway drug, because I really found something in every drug that I did after that was kind of looking for that first marijuana high experience. So I kind of feel like that stuff really does bring you back. I had like 3 months, and then I was like, I'm good. You know, I'm clean and I feel healthy. But this program I went through was a ministry deal. We went to lots of churches, but we didn't go to AA outside meetings. When I left there, I had full intention to go to church, and I was even given like, I might even been get a list of AA meetings around town. And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do this. And I probably even looked at them. I was familiar with the churches, but I didn't go to that, even though I was familiar. And the AA, I absolutely wasn't going to that, because I'd never been there, and I don't know anything about it, and I don't do things that I don't know anything about. I have to know all about it, and I have to be great at it before I do it. I live in that much fear. Now, not so much. So I didn't have any kind of program. I lasted 2 weeks. I was working, and I'm tired, and I'm like, well, just a little bit will take the edge off. I'll just do a little bit. Like you hear a lot of people say, that relapse mindset, that I can do a little bit. And I didn't even do that. I went straight to shooting up. And 3 weeks in, Katrina hit. So I was dope sick in the Superdome, and there was a big part of me that said, thank fucking God that this happened, because I knew that 2 weeks, I was right where I was. Like, it wasn't even a joke. I saw it happening, and I was just not happy about the situation, but this is what I do. This is just what I do. I just shoot dope, and that's life, you know? That little bit of recovery I had, that's not me. That's not a life I can have. That's not what I do. It's so unfamiliar. I hadn't spent enough time doing it. I had spent so much time doing drugs. So when Katrina hit, I felt some relief in that. That I knew that I was going to be sick, and I was glad that I was forced into that situation. I ended up in Texas for a little bit. I ended up going back about 6 months after Katrina. And I started drinking heavy again. And this time, it was even heavier than before. So I hadn't been really drinking much when I was using heroin. For that time, I'd drink real slow, and I wouldn't drink very much, and I never got drunk. But as soon as that heroin was gone, I started picking up where I left off, and I drank even more. I drank like a fifth of whiskey. Like, within a week after Katrina getting back, I was drinking a fifth of whiskey a night. And I found another guy, an enabler friend, who was just as sick as me, and he was drinking just as much as me. And we just drank all the time into oblivion. And that added element of Katrina, we were just lost for good. And it wasn't too long, it was like about a month or so, that heroin had come back into the city. And again, as soon as it was available, it's what I knew, it was what I was familiar with, and it's what I went back to. And that was like about 3 months of a relapse. That's when I OD'd. That's when I OD'd and then came to and then was like cooking up. Like, it was the scariest, worst using of my life, and it was the smallest chunk of my using. And that was the first time that I really was like, I have to do something. I am going to die. I am not enjoying this. I'm sick of being sick. I'm sick all the time. I'm getting jerked around all the time. None of these people fucking care. This is no life. And I got on a bus. I called my dad, and I scammed some money, and I got on a bus and went back to Des Moines, Iowa. I had gone there once before to try to get clean to a methadone program, and I abused it and ended up going back down to New Orleans. It was like a small little window of 6 months that I went back home to try to do something. And I think the only reason I did that was because everybody kicked me out and I didn't have any place else to go. But this time, I ended up going back. I did the program the right way. I did a step down, and I got clean. And again, I didn't have any program of recovery after that. This is all self-action, self-will. I didn't have any AA. I didn't have any NA. I no longer had any kind of people I was talking to at the clinic. So I'm out by myself. I'm clean and sober. I don't know how to live clean and sober. I did go to church, and I did kind of hang around, and I got a job cleaning the church. And I was completely sober for maybe a month. And then I started drinking a little bit because, you know, I'm okay now. I've got the heroin kick, and I can drink. At none of this time do I acknowledge that my drinking is really a problem. You know, I saw really destructive, but I don't ever acknowledge that it's a problem and I need to get rid of it. So I did finally get clean, and that was a huge, huge struggle for me. And that was one of my main things, and that's my drug of choice, and that's what I keep coming back. But when I quit that, my alcoholism picked up where it left off. I started drinking a fifth of whiskey a night, and I didn't have any money. I lived with other drunks, and I scrounged for money, and I scammed for money. And I just continued to do this train wreck. And some of the people that would drink with me were kind of like, I think they drank with me because they were afraid not to. Like, I was going to come and kick their door in anyway and make them. So they're like, well, we better just go along with it. And in fact, one girl, she said, because I was like, drink all the time. She said she had this trick where she'd put her thumb over the nozzle and actually act like she was drinking it. But she would block it off. She was like, you're crazy, you know. Once you start drinking, you're just, like, insane. But she kept hanging around. I don't know. She had something that had to be nuts with her, too. So I had a drunk driving charge in Iowa that I didn't face when I went down to New Orleans. At the time that I've got clean and I'm drinking, I wasn't really doing anything, so I didn't even really know about or acknowledge it. But eventually I had a girlfriend that had a car, and I was borrowing her car, and I crashed it drunk. So I got a DUI, one first offense, and a DUI second offense all at once. And I had to go to drunk camp, where I had to go out to a barracks and stay there for a couple nights on one weekend. And then I had to go back next weekend and stay out there. And it was like 10 hours of experts coming in and people telling their stories about somebody who their son was killed in a drunk driving accident or something like that. And I really got a lot out of that, and I did enjoy it. And when I left there, I drank. You know, it all made sense to me. And I didn't drink while I was there, so that was a whole weekend without alcohol. That was a good start. But, you know, some part of my brain just was like, yeah, okay. You know, and I keep drinking, and it's like, it doesn't click that, like, you got to leave this alone. You got to get away from it, because I didn't have a program. I never had a program. So I hit a point where I had a job in the bicycle industry building bikes. I had some stability finally after Katrina. I'd lived with this girl, and I was, you know, after the car wreck and she stayed with me, I'm like, will you marry me? You know, you're going to stay with me forever. I love you. That was the best thing ever. I can't believe you stayed with me. And so we were engaged, and we had an apartment together, and I was serious about trying to live a good life and a right life. So I cut down on the drinking. And after the accident, it was like no booze, no hard liquor in the house. We'd have some beer. So this was like the whole Mad Men, you know, I'm getting sober, so I'm just drinking beer. And it kind of worked, you know. I got a little more sober. You know, I had these progressions on my own. And I got more and more sober. And I was drinking like on the weekends. And it was still some liquor coming in there sometimes, but when it did, it was like, okay, red lights, we got to kind of try to manage this more. And as I got more and more sober, I started to see my relationship was a codependent, enabling, you know, nightmare. So we ended up splitting up. And once we split up, I made serious effort. I was like, I want to quit drinking. I absolutely don't like it anymore. I don't like being in the bar. I don't like the people I talk to. And for 2 years, I tried. I tried on my own. I would get a month. I would get 2 months. But I didn't know how to live sober. I didn't have any kind of program. And I hit, this is where what would be considered to me my bottom. And it wasn't the crash in the cars. It wasn't homelessness. It wasn't the psychotic rampage, that the embarrassment and the demoralization. It was the fact that I had tried for 2 years to quit on my own. I absolutely never enjoyed it during that 2 years. I didn't want to do it, and I couldn't do it on my own. And it broke me, and I fucking broke down crying, smoking a cigarette, and I felt completely lost and hopeless. And I knew that there was a meeting down the street because I had tried to get somebody else to go with me. During this 2 years, I'm like, let's go to AA. Come on. That, you know, I knew it might help. But, you know, nobody would go with me. And being like a codependent person, I can't go unless somebody's going with me. I can't do things unless somebody forces me. And I hit that broken point where I went on my own. And I was shaky. I was like, there's a meeting down the road, and I just wanted to sit down and wait and wait till it was too late to go. And I'm shaking. I'm physically shaking, and a part of my brain's going, go now. Just go right now. Just go. And I get my keys, and I lock my door, and I run like I'm fucking being hunted. Like, it was intense. In my mind, this big turning point was just, it was severe. I knew that if I didn't, I was going to die. I knew I was going to die, even though it was like the best it had ever been. At some point, I was going to get so frustrated that using was going to come back in the picture. And today, I know that if I ever use, it's not going to be a chance to come back, because where I left off was just death. It was very much death. So I got in there, and as soon as I walked in for the first time to the AA meeting, they greeted me, they were friendly, there was coffee. I immediately felt a sense of relief because I had done it once, I could do it again. And that was that whole learning to live sober. If I learned how to do something once, I can do it again. And I knew that I'd come every day. And I did. I went every day, and people were nice to me, and they were glad to see me. That was something new. I haven't experienced that in a very long time. And I felt that love. Like, these people actually care. And then, you know, that's where I kind of like, this is what I'm looking for. This is what I've been trying to fill. This is that lonely, lost incompleteness that I've had, that drugs and alcohol has always been trying to ease the suffering of. Where am I at? Oh, God. Yeah, I got a lot of backstory and not a lot of step work because I'm a slacker. But I did go. And I listened to everything they said. It was a very tight-knit group. And this is looking back. After I got a year sober, I'm looking back. I finally got a sponsor, and I'm ready to do the step work. The whole time, I look back and I reflect on this after a year. The whole time that first year, I really was doing step one, two, and three. I was really coming to terms with that. The people that were in my tight-knit group, we met five times a week. They were a GLBT group and friends group in the Midwest, so they were very tight-knit and very open. And they, you know, they had a lot of sobriety. Like, a guy that went every day, this guy Carl, he had like 20 years. He had been in the Des Moines, you know, AA community forever, and he'd gone to a bunch of meetings, and now he plopped down in this meeting, and this is his home. And so all these people, I went 15 minutes early. I stayed half hour, 15 minutes afterwards, and I talked to them because this is what I wanted, and this is where I got it, and I wanted to get as much as I could. And I'd go fellowship with them when they wanted to go out to, you know, to eat, because they had what I wanted. I desperately wanted it. And I was terrified that I wasn't going to be able to leave the other thing behind, because I could feel during that, well, I'd probably say the first 6 months, I could feel some kind of pull, trying to pull back to what I was familiar with, because this new thing wasn't familiar. I knew it was healthy. I knew it was better. I probably had more of a struggle because I didn't jump right into the steps, and I didn't jump in with a sponsor. But this guy, Carl, man, he'll even tell you when he shares, he's like, I sit there and I work your program and I take your inventory. And so his little character defect there kind of worked out in my benefit, because he was ready to tell me what I wanted to hear when I asked him, like, what about this? What about this? And he's like, well, this is what I see and all that. So I kind of got some temporary sponsorship for that first year. And admittedly, I did get a sponsor, but I never called him and we never talked. And it just was like, just kind of made me feel a little more safe and a little more connected to the program. So my experience with 1, 2, and 3, because this part's new to me. Like, when I told my story before, it was with that home group, and they just didn't know a lot about my backstory. So it was a lot of that. So step one, I admitted I was powerless a long time ago. Like a lot of people say that. Second half, admitting that my life had become unmanageable, that kind of wavered. You know, when shit goes right, my life's manageable. When it doesn't go right, it's unmanageable. But in truth, it was always unmanageable. I just had a lot of blessings, and I should have took advantage of those miracle moments. And I've been riddled with miracle moments throughout my life. And the fact that I made it to that first meeting, that is a humongous miracle, because that's why I felt so shaky, because I knew on my own power I couldn't get to that meeting. So I believe in a power greater than me, a spiritual whatever, that got me to that first one. That saved my life. You know, it did. It saved my life. If I wouldn't have gone that first one, I would be dead. I would not be here. So 2 and 3... 1, 2, and 3 was pretty much what I was doing the first one. Let me see, because I'm nervous and stuff. Now, the belief that I could be restored to sanity, I knew I was insane. There wasn't a question about that. I did believe that healthy action could lead to a more healthier mindset, but I did not believe when I went in that I could have what those people had. I did not believe that I could be restored to sanity. I just was so desperate. I wanted to believe that that was true. I wanted it to be true, but I didn't really believe it. And it did take a lot of time for me to believe that this shit was possible for me, that it really was. When I got to like 3-4 months and I had beat the record of what longest time sober, you know, it's not really about the numbers of how many months or whatever. It was the longest time I'd ever been sober since I, except for that. No. That time in New Orleans that I had 3 months, like when I hit 3 months in one day, it was the longest I'd been sober since I was 10 years old. And that's when I was like, something is different. And that's when I started to believe that I could be restored to sanity and I could have what they had. And over the months, over a little bit more time, I kept hanging around. That really made me feel great. So that was incentive to come back when I was starting to believe something could be given to me too. As I came, more was revealed, and getting into the program and fellowshipping and being a part of it was getting easier. I still was one of those oppositional people. Every time somebody was like, you need to get a sponsor and work the steps, I'm like, yeah, whatever, dude. You know, I know what I'm doing. I read the whole book. I had the 12 and 12, and I read all that stuff. And I did practice the principles in all my affairs, but not having worked the steps officially in that first year, I really didn't have a good understanding of how this stuff works. But it was enough to keep me sober. It was some white knuckle crap.
Number three, made a decision to turn my will in life.
Well, I think I kind of did that when I first went to that meeting. But to fully surrender everything, I really have to say that I don't really feel like I fully got that third step 100% until I was years into this, because I still had a lot of emotional shit I was dealing with. I was 90% in, but I remember having like a miracle moment where I felt completely transformed, and I was like, everything of my life, I want it to be purpose-driven. I want to be in this thing. I want this miracle. I want this spirit, this higher power that I believe. I want it with me forever and ever. That's it. I like this, and I feel good, and I feel loved. Because I wouldn't have stayed with this program if I didn't ever feel better. Like, initially, I did it because I didn't want to do any more destruction, and I was feeling like shit, and I wanted some relief. But I wouldn't have stuck around if I wouldn't have started to feel better. And I can tell you today, I've gone, like, if this was feeling good when I was using, like, I'm probably up at the moon, you know. It's just beyond what I could have comprehended ever. Where am I at? How much time? I got, like, 5 minutes. Okay, so step four, I had 2 pages of my first column of my resentments. And then everything else was like a sentence or two. So just the act of writing it out, I learned something. Like, I'm bitching and complaining, you know, blaming everybody for everything that's ever happened. And that was, just writing it out was the first time that I actually considered that I had a part in things. That where it talks about in the book that when we really look at it, we are the creators of all our problems. So when I went to sit down and actually put pen to paper and do this, my first draft had 2 pages in my bitching and complaining, and I saw that that's what I was doing, and I got a little more precise, and I started to learn what a resentment is, the difference between resentment and just complaints. And then I got with my sponsor, who at that time I had finally got a solid sponsor and met with regularly. He had like 10 years sobriety, and he had a really good program. And he went through this stuff, and he explained it to me, like how this stuff works out. And I saw that it came down to like just so much of my life was fear. And it had a lot to do with like my, you know, faith in a higher power. Because if I'm afraid of death, then I'm having a lack of faith. And that's where it usually comes back to almost all the time. I think that anybody working a 4-step, after you do it so many times, you're going to find that there's going to be just some basic stuff. And that's part of that, you know, spiritual maintenance, the daily reprieve, because some of these things can't go away. They're kind of normal and natural, and we just got to tend to them and get them into a place of understanding and acceptance over and over. That's just with me. I do go through that. Like the fear thing, like I'm up here. As soon as he said something to me, I was terrified, and I even said, like, I'm completely freaked out. But I have been through this before, and when I get freaked out and I have big fear, I know where it comes from, and I know that that doesn't have to have power over me, that I can just lean into it and I can give it my best shot. I don't have to be perfect, and I'm never going to be. All right, I gotta zip along. So I'll just get to some of these. Like, so I got with my sponsor, he explained a bunch. Now the sixth part, I had to spend some time there. I spent a lot of time there because once I identify him, I can say, yeah, I want this gone because it created a lot of problems. I don't want fear. I don't want all this stuff. But to be willing to let go of something that was familiar to me, even if it was bad and painful, that takes some time because I'm insecure and it's driven by fear. So I spend more time on six than anything. And once I get that down, you know, there's 7 right there. It's just there waiting for me. So steps 8 and 9, a lot of the people, it was kind of one of those things where I'm living men's a lot. And it's healthy for me that that's happening because I'm a giver. Because I take, I manipulated, the people that I harmed, for the most part, contacting them would be like, if you ever call me again, I'm getting a restraining order. I made a mess. I'm lucky I don't have a bunch of restraining orders out there. Like, thank God for their sickness. I don't know. But like family, that was something that I did need to make amends. But, you know, my brother and my father and, you know, my mother and I was real close to my grandpa and grandma. They knew alcoholism from my dad. They've been through this. They understand. And really, they just wanted to see me sober. So that living amends of me being sober, staying sober, and living a good life and a right life, that was an amends. But I did do a formal apology. And I knew where they stood on it. I knew that the living amends was the thing that I needed to do. I did do a formal, and they were like, we're just really glad and happy, and it made me feel good. And there's a lot of fuzzies around that. There was a couple uncomfortable ones where I would, like, because I got sober in Des Moines, when I was sober, I started to go to shows, out to see bands, when I got comfortable enough to be in that environment. And in the act of doing so, I'd run into a couple bartenders here and there of the nightmares, you know, like of when I was drinking and out of control, and I'm saying, just give me a tab, and they're giving me free drinks to shut me up, and there's, like, a couple times threatened to call the police. I ran into a couple of them, and I had to make a spot on the spot amends. I could have easily ducked out and avoided them, but, you know, I had been hanging around this for a little bit before that happened, and I saw them, and I immediately was like, I faced that fear, and I said, I'm really sorry. You know, I'm really sorry that I acted the way I am. I've been sober, and they were drunk, of course, and they're like, no, I'm just glad you're okay, you know, so... I was like, okay. And a couple times of that, it made me feel pretty comfortable with being uncomfortable with making amends. I think I've had to make amends since I worked here. I think I've been a little bit, like, had a little bit of a weird attitude and apologized. Because that's what it looks like for me today. When I have to make amends, it's a small thing and it's not a very big deal. I make things up in my head to be a big deal. I overcomplicate things. And when I'm like, admit the truth, and like, okay, I'm kind of like a jerk here. It's really small, and it's not hard to do. It's just, you know, recognizing and being a grown-up, admitting to myself is usually the hardest part nowadays. Because that spiritual maintenance, you stay on top of that with this, like, 10, 11, 12. Keep contact and keep walking in the principles. Like, every step, everything I do, it doesn't matter if I'm, like, at the post office. Everybody there is in my program. Everybody there I have to be accountable to. Like complete strangers that I think are never going to see me again. You know, I have to treat them exactly how I need to treat people that I see every day that are going to hold me accountable. You know, it's not slick and slimy day. It's where I have to be honest all the time because for me and for my higher power connection. And I do my nightlies, meditate, all that stuff, and keep contact. And like I said, that spiritual maintenance, once you get to a point, like the early recovery is a bitch because you got to clean up. You got to clean up that garden and it's been overgrown and stuff. But when you get to a certain point, it becomes pretty easy and it becomes natural. And that's what makes me feel good is because I'm already in that natural state. And then that 12th step, now this is why I'm working for the alumni program, because that 12th step, that brings me right back in so that I see and I never forget the pain and suffering I went through to get here. And I'm of service. That feeling of uselessness is gone completely. Like, I'm doing a service right now, man. I feel great. It's awesome. I feel even better now. But... it has not been easy to make ends meet at part-time right now, and I know this will grow. I know it because I feel that conscious contact with my higher power, and I'm doing it because this alumni program is important. I know how important it is because my early sobriety, seeing the same faces, seeing people that are succeeding, seeing their miracles help me believe in my miracles, and now that I'm where I am, and I'm seeing other people's miracles and them getting sober, now I can, like, sometimes I text people out of the blue from my home group and go, man, I'm so glad you were there. I get it, you know. Seeing people change. Because when I told my story there, they were like, afterwards, they had known me for a while. They came up and they were like, we didn't think you were going to make it at all. Man, you kept coming back. And for months, we were like waiting for you to drop off. And you just wouldn't. So... They must have really got a kick out of me seeing me succeed. That must have been like some reaffirming holy power. So life is really good now. All this stuff, all this accumulation of the program. This last month I had the flu, I had bronchitis, I had a coughing fit which pinched a nerve. I've been physically miserable, but I have laughed. I have been happy every day. I have continued to work. I never think of coming to work as a chore. I'm glad to do it, and I'm talking forever because I like it here. I'm going to shut up.